Welcome to the Discover Strength podcast. I'm Luke Carlson. I'm the CEO of Discover Strength, and I'm an exercise physiologist. And this episode, we are joined by Dr. James Fisher at Solent University in the United Kingdom. Dr. Fisher is an exercise science researcher with a real focus in strength training or resistance exercise. So he's publishing research on a regular basis. And of course, he's teaching undergraduate and graduate courses in all things exercise science. Dr. Fisher, thank you so much for joining us today.
Luke, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast.
Now, Dr. Fisher has been on the podcast a few times over the last few years. He's a wonderful friend of Discover Strength. We've had the privilege of publishing a number of studies with Dr. Fisher and some of his other colleagues. I view Dr. Fisher right now, I think most of the strength training world, the academic strength training world, views Dr. Fisher as, you know, the number one or number two strength and muscle hypertrophy researchers in the world. So we're lucky to have him with us today. What we want to talk about today is, you know, Discover Strength uses this terminology that we're evidence-based. We're using an evidence-based approach to strength training. Well, what does that mean? Why do you care if your workout is evidence-based? So I thought, who better to have on to talk about this and how this is relevant for your workouts than Dr. James Fisher? So my background around evidence-based and the notion of making a workout evidence-based really roots back to my undergraduate degree at the University of Minnesota. And I've told this story so many times, but I'm sitting in a classroom studying motor units or muscle fibers or some aspect of exercise physiology or biomechanics, whatever it was, thinking to myself, I love this and I love studying this stuff. But in that moment, I distinctly remember thinking, well, we're not studying this in a vacuum. If all of this scientific discovery doesn't trickle down and actually connect to how a human being works out, then all of this is for naught. We're not studying it in a vacuum. And I knew at that time, this is the year 2000, that there's a lot of people working out. They just weren't working out in a way that was reflective of all of this scientific research. So I said, well, I'm going to spend the rest of my working life trying to bridge the gap between the scientific research, and this is what James does for a living, what Dr. Fisher does for a living. I want to bridge the gap between that scientific research and how people actually work out. So to me, that's kind of the foundation of evidence-based training, or at least my interest in evidence-based training. We didn't call it evidence-based training in the year 2000. I looked at it as, well, how can scientific research influence how we do strength training? And then I think over the last few decades, the terminology evidence-based has been popularized first in medicine. We see it in medicine, we see it in policy, we see it in education. And big picture, we want to talk today about what that actually means. So Dr. Fisher, I'm going to turn that first question over to you. When you use terminology evidence-based, give us an idea. What does evidence-based mean?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And there's actually more to unpack than I think people might realize. For me, there are three facets to an evidence-based process or an evidence-based protocol. And the first facet, and the one that's probably most commonly overlooked, is a clear understanding of the client, the patient, maybe the condition, the situation, the goals, and so on and so forth. And without that, you really can't find a direction or start to have a strategic approach to what you need to do. So from there, once you've got a clear understanding, you can then start to move into the body of research and move through the body of research to find a strategic approach based on this scientific literature. And that in itself is a huge amount to unpack. We can get into the different sort of pyramid approach to what is good quality research and anecdotes up to meta-analyses and so forth. But fundamentally, there's a body of research there to get through to outline an approach towards dealing with that patient, with that client, that condition, those goals. And then from there, in the third part, and possibly one of the more overlooked parts, is also a need to have the skill set to deliver the methods that are being discussed within the academic research, and an understanding of the research to be able to deliver that. Now, in some cases, there's a requirement to upskill. And we know in the medical profession, as technology moves forward, as in the exercise industry, as technology moves forward, there's a requirement to either maintain professional skill sets or upskill based on technology and so forth to be able to use new techniques and so forth. And I think those, for me, are the three facets that determine an evidence-based process or an evidence-based approach to resolving any problem, whether that's anywhere within the healthcare system or medical industry or within exercise industry as well. So looking at what Discover Strengths do, obviously there's an understanding of the clients, of their of maybe the condition that they come in, whether that's a medical condition or whether that's, you know, pregnancy or simply their goals to build strength, hypertrophy, prevent illness, lose weight, so on and so forth. Then an ability to immerse themselves in the literature. Now, we've talked extensively about this in the past, but obviously the exercise physiologists at Discover Strength don't just read the research, but they submit themselves to the research and engage in the research process themselves, as you said. And then obviously we know how skilled your trainers are, so I'm not going to wax lyrical about that. I'll let you do that. But they certainly have the skill set to deliver the protocols that are discussed in the literature.
Dr. Fisher, your starting point there was so important. What you mentioned, the benefit. We have to understand what is the outcome that we're actually interested in, what's the objective of the patient or the client in this case. And when I think about exercise, over the last 25 years, so many people ask me, like, are you pro? Are you an advocate of fill in the blank type of exercise, modality of exercise, variable of exercise? And I always have to back up and say, well, what's the objective? What's the outcome that you're seeking? And so we can't say, is this good or bad? We have to say, well, what are we seeking? I think even the well-informed exerciser makes the mistake that, well, there's one broad set of exercise benefits that we just get from exercise, and tell me what's the best form of exercise to give me those broad benefits. But when we look at the scientific research, we're always looking at, well, specifically, what's the outcome that we're interested in actually improving? So what would those outcomes potentially be? Well, muscle strength, muscle hypertrophy, bone mineral density, improvement in cognitive function, mitigation of cardiovascular disease risk factors, the strength of the evidence around mitigation of all-cause mortality risk factors. So there's a lot of different benefits or outcomes that we could be seeking. So when someone says, is this type of exercise, variable of exercise, is this good? Are you an advocate of this? It always depends on, well, what's your objective? And that's where we have to start. So thank you for mentioning that. Now, when we think about the value of using an evidence-based approach, this is maybe too simplistic, Dr. Fisher, but I always say there's two big categories I like to look at. I like to look at benefits. We turn to the scientific evidence to tell us what are the benefits of strength training, and all we can unpack this, but I would suggest that 20 years ago, we simply had no idea. We couldn't have predicted how beneficial strength training was actually going to be for us. We just didn't have that much research, late 90s, early 2000s, around so many of these health protective benefits. So, number one, we have to look at the scientific evidence around benefits. And number two, I think we have to look at the scientific evidence, of course, around how do we manipulate workout variables, the exercise variables, to actually produce better results? So I would call that second broad category methodology. Now, let's be clear around benefits. These are not intuitive. And the average exerciser sometimes thinks they are intuitive. I like to joke that you should never read the comment section on an online, newspaper periodical of any kind around exercise, because the comments are like, why'd they have to be a study on this? I've known this. I've exercised for 35 years and I've known this. Well, so much of it is just not intuitive. So much of what we do in strength training is not intuitive. The benefits are not intuitive. I do not think it was intuitive that if you engage in regular resistance training, you can enhance or restore cognitive function. I don't think that's intuitive. Now, maybe it's intuitive that my muscles would get stronger if I strength train, but it's not intuitive that regardless of how much weight I lift or how many reps I do, my muscle strength and my muscle endurance essentially improve in a linear fashion. So when we try to understand benefits, it's, some of these benefits are just not intuitive, and that's why it's worth it to do the research. So, Dr. Fisher, those are my two big categories, benefits and methodology. I know that's probably too simplistic for you, but I want you to comment on that. When we look at the scientific research, what else are we trying to understand? Are those two good categories? What did I leave out on those categories?
I think they're two great categories when you approach the research. So one of the things that before we even get to those points, one of the things I try and instill in my students is an ability to be critical scientific research. If the research supports our point, then what was wrong with the research? If the research challenges our point, then what was good about the research? We shouldn't be looking for studies that simply support our existing perspectives. And the reality is that that in itself is a skill. But research is there to try to bias you and to try to fool you. We've seen research that supports the health benefits of red wine, but we don't turn around and say, oh, well, in that case, don't drink any water. Let's just drink red wine all day. We all know that the research can be misinterpreted in that way. So I think, first of all, we need to have a critical viewpoint and a critical perspective of research. I think if we look at the health benefits of strength training, for me, more and more so with anybody I work with, it's about ill health avoidance. When we're young, the muscle size and muscle strength are fantastic, and as we age, they're incredibly important. We know that muscle strength and muscle size are linked to all-cause mortality. But the reality is, it's all the other health benefits that we get from our strength training, whether it's things that are a relatively new area like myokines, or like you said, cognitive function, or cardiorespiratory fitness, or bone mineral density, that we're not seeing for ill health. So it's almost not about the benefits that we see today, but about the negative impacts that we don't see tomorrow because of what we did today. And I think that's really important. And it's completely, it's hard. You can't tell somebody this is what you're not going to see tomorrow because of what you did today. But that's the reality of healthcare and strength training as a healthcare process. And then, of course, when we look at the methods of strength training, we talk about the multiple variables that are out there, whether it's the equipment being used or the repetition duration or the volume or frequency or rest intervals and so on and so forth. There's just an absolute a plethora of research out there that's going to try and steer us in one direction or another, almost to the extent where the governing bodies have muddied the water so much that they've almost tried to confuse the layperson into an inability to perform strength training. The most common barriers to strength training are time, as we would all expect, and then, of course, a confusion over what to do, a lack of comprehension over how to plan or deliver a workout. Now, that's not to say that a workout shouldn't be supervised, but I think the reality is workouts can be a lot simpler than some of these organizations, some of this research proposes. Did you want me to get into some of the methods around this, or?
Yeah, well, talk to us, James, about how we actually do this research. And maybe a more specific way to approach the question is, I interact with so many people that say, but you can find a study or you can find research that proves anything. So as a researcher yourself, what are we looking for in good research?
Yeah, okay. So one of my favorite studies of the last year or so was the Inez et al. Study that supposedly proposed 52 sets of training for the quadriceps. And when you look at that study at face value, and I've seen that study critiqued in blogs and on YouTube channels and so on and so forth, at face value, that proposes that there's a dose response relationship between volume and strength training. But the reality is, the group that did 52 sets of lower body exercise for their quadriceps, 26 sets each workout for their quadriceps, in total per week, they did 28 minutes of exercise. And they did 114 minutes of sitting, waiting for the next set of exercise. Now, I don't know about you, Luke. I don't have 114 minutes to sit around and wait for the next set. And if I want to do 28 minutes of exercise for my quadriceps, I'm going to get in the gym and I'm going to try and get 28 minutes of exercise done in about a 30-minute block. And the reality is most people that are probably even doing a low volume approach to strength training are getting somewhere close to that 28 minutes in a week across two or three workouts without all the rest intervals and so forth. But we don't get that unless we get into the weeds of the research itself. So of course, studies can propose high volume or heavier loads or so forth, but without really getting into the critical analysis of what they did well or what they did poorly, it's hard to see that. And of course, many organizations have suggested that we should have 2 to 3 minute rest intervals between sets and so forth. But of course, this is not a time efficient approach to strength training.
So one of the other things that we can do, and I want you to comment on this, is rather than looking at just one study, what you are generally trying to do is look at a preponderance of scientific research. So a paper comes out, there's 32 subjects, this is what the authors conclude. And of course, you're going to look at the design of the study and the supervision that was involved, and you're going to look at, was there enough subjects to actually elicit the power needed in the study? But beyond one study, we try to look at the preponderance of evidence. So tell us what that means. When we look at a preponderance of evidence to guide best practice, what does that look like to you, James?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, most people heavily rely upon anecdotes. I had a friend who did this and they got bigger or they got weaker or they got healthier or they lost weight. And so they're going to try it. But of course, we can't extrapolate data from a single person across to 1,000 people or 10,000 people or a population or, the global population. So anecdotes really just lose any quality at that point. Now we can move into case studies where variables are measured a lot more quantifiably, but it's still a very, very low sample. So we start to move into randomized controlled trials or crossover design trials, which obviously, skill strength have been a part of. These are good methodological designs where you have two groups of people forming two different intervention strategies or a control group where there is no intervention. And then ultimately, what you're looking for is enough randomized controlled trials, which are probably still notably underpowered, which means they just don't have a large enough sample. But you're looking for a meta-analysis or a systematic review and meta-analysis that encompasses and collects the body of literature, both statistically and descriptively, talk about the different approaches and protocols that were used and the culmination of the adaptive response. By instead of there being 100 people in 10 different studies, now 1,000 people within this meta-analysis. And that's really kind of the echelon, the tip of the spear when it comes to research. But of course, we can still be biased when we perform meta-analyses. So they're not flawless in themselves. And the statistical analysis is constantly moving forward. I work very closely with a phenomenal statistician, Dr. James Steele. And, we look back at meta-analyses over the past 10 years and statistics has changed so much that there are far better ways to approach answering these questions. So it's a difficult game to keep up with to some extent, and this is where guidelines should continually evolve and should continually update their approach to what is evidence-based, what are the evidence-based protocol. In the UK, we have what's called the NICE guidelines, and that's anything that's a medical, physiotherapeutic, or medical approach, proposed by the government and so forth. So, but we have these different levels of quality of research as well.
Yeah, fantastic. So James, I want to put a wrap on this, and here's how I'll conclude. And you mentioned it, rather than turning to someone who is more fit than we are, who can run faster, jump higher, has bigger muscles, has lower body fat, whatever it is, the idea of evidence-based means, well, we can't rely on testimonial, we can't rely on anecdote. Instead, we just look at the preponderance of evidence on any one of these categories. And I had someone ask me, I mean, literally decades ago, what if you did a workout? What if you planned your workouts just around the preponderance or the outcomes of the scientific research? Why couldn't you just do that? And to our listeners, and you know this, James, because we've known each other so well for so many years, this is what Discover Strength represents. What if you created a workout that started with the research rather than starting with, here's how I think we should work out, and I hope we can find some research to substantiate what we do. So to me, that's what an evidence-based approach is. And then what does it actually mean for our workout? I think it probably means three things. Well, number one, a chance at better results. Our results are always going to be influenced by our own genetic predisposition, but we at least have a chance at producing better results. Number two is more efficient results. Can I produce those same results in far less time? And then lastly, safer training. We just look at so much exercise science research that tries to unpack how do we do this in a safer manner? And to me, that's to a large extent what we're all chasing, better results in less time and in the safest manner possible. And on behalf of all of our listeners, Dr. Fisher, and of course, all of our staff who've interacted with you for so many years, thank you for being just an international leader in this area, a great sounding board for us, a great teacher to us. I first met you in 2014, but had read your work for a number of years before that. So thank you for joining us today, and thank you for the great contribution you continue to make to our field, Dr. Fisher.
Thank you very much.